Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Today we hear from Brian Jacobs, the Vice President of Government and External Affairs at BMW. One of the coolest guys working for one of the coolest companies. Brian is just a thoughtful, knowledgeable person. And he tells a story about how he was very surprised to get his first internship, how he was picked out of 40 people. But after you meet Brian, we were not surprised at all. Paid his own way through college, has worked on the Hill for a number of years, and he tells some great stories about that. Worked at Home Depot, which has a reputation for having a top-rated government affairs office. And now he is at BMW, one of the most iconic car companies, really, in the world. So enjoy the show. So we are here today with Brian Jacobs, the Vice President of Government and External Affairs at BMW, the iconic car company. We're here at the Denton offices in Washington, D.C., downtown Washington, D.C. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
So, Brian, I was doing an interview, and the person I was interviewing owned several 2002 BMWs.
Yeah.
I think he owned five.
Okay.
That is quite a cult following that that car has. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You nailed it when you said it's an iconic brand. We have an incredible brand loyalty at BMW. People who typically buy BMW cars do it for probably all the same reason. They have something deep down inside of them that loves performance vehicles. It's an iconic brand for people who really love to drive. And once people have them, they typically stick with it. So the 2002 is one of the first cars ever built that paired a sedan with performance. So it was as if you were all of a sudden in the United States, minus all the American muscle cars, this was one of the first brands of foreign cars that came to the United States that paired a luxury sedan. Now, to today's standards, pretty pared down, but still a luxury sedan with high performance and a very different feel from American muscle cars.
So BMW, in 2016, you celebrated 100 years.
That's right.
Got your start originally in airplanes.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Airplane engines.
Airplane engines.
Yeah, right.
And then shortly thereafter, I think motorcycles.
Yes.
And today you're a $100 billion plus company. Over 2 million plus BMW sold last year, I believe.
Right.
And motorcycles are obviously also a big part of that. I don't know how many.
They are. There aren't many car manufacturers that also manufacture motorcycles. Honda does as well, but BMW brand motorcycles are somewhat of an anomaly. Most auto companies are diversified, but they're not diversified so much that they're also building motorcycles. But we are one of those.
Right. So let's go back up. You got your start at the University of Wyoming. That sounds like an incredibly beautiful place to go to college. Was it?
It depends on what your standards are. It was incredibly beautiful during the months between maybe April and October.
Okay.
Between the months of October and March, it was a fairly miserable place to go to school. It was cold, and if you didn't like the cold, it was not great. But you adapt to that. I was born actually in North Dakota, so
okay.
I grew up in cold weather. Then moved on to Wyoming, where the University of Wyoming was just a logical place for me to go to school.
And if you're not into winter sports like skiing or whatever, it's probably a long winter.
It could be, but we were into skiing on the cheap, so you would go do things like the local ski resort, which was maybe two or three runs. But if you didn't do that and you didn't want to spend the couple bucks to go to that, you would strap your skis and your boots on your back with maybe a case of beer or so, and you would climb glaciers and ski glaciers.
Really?
Yeah. So that was really great. You could find plenty to do in the outdoors.
Wow.
at the University of Wyoming in Laramie.
What did you major in?
Well, I started with a philosophy major, but quickly, as most of the decisions in my life have been made by women much smarter than me, I met a woman in one of my classes, and she talked me into running for student government. And with that, I got the bug for politics a little bit, you know, politics at the very minor league level.
Yeah.
And ran for arts and sciences senator for the Associated Students at the University of Wyoming. That's the government entity. So I did that, ran and won for that position, and served in student government for a couple of years.
Okay. And so did each school have a senator?
That's right. So nursing school had a senator. Every school was represented by at least one senator.
And did you like it?
I did. I loved it. It was more social than it was anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever accomplished anything that was worthwhile.
I was going to say, what were the burning issues?
No real burning issues that I remember, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of great camaraderie. And the best part about it was you were able to talk to people who had a lot of the same wants and desires and goals that you had if you were to go into politics. So with that, I did change my major to political science and minored in philosophy, but really got the bug from starting to study political science.
Okay. And then what'd you do after college?
Well, I worked my way through college. Neither of my parents went to school, and I was never encouraged to go to school by my parents. But again, a woman who I knew in high school's mother was a college guidance counselor, and she talked me into making the move to go to the University of Wyoming. And as I did that, I had, with the knowledge that I had to pay for every cent of school on my own, I worked almost as much as I went to school. And so it took me a little longer than most people, but it was because I was working typically full-time jobs. So with that, I was catering.
Okay.
Flexible hours, good money, free food. And in college, that means everything. And so I did that. And so after I graduated, well, as I was about to graduate, one of my employees came to me with an article in the student newspaper saying that the senator from Wyoming, Malcolm Wallop, was looking for interns. And I interviewed for the job with 40 other people who were also interviewing for the job, and miraculously was offered the position. So that was May of 1993, went out in September of 93, and was Malcolm Wallop's intern and did a lot of work for him as he was on the Senate Finance Committee, and they were doing a little trade agreement called NAFTA.
Wow.
And that was my first foray into trade.
So the catering that you did in college, was it your catering business?
No, it was actually part of the University of Wyoming.
Oh, okay.
And so we had exclusive contracts with all events that were at the on campus.
Okay.
We catered. So it was, I ran the company for a long time. In fact, I went back after my internship with Senator Wallop to go back to Laramie to see about getting an advanced degree. And while I was exploring that, they offered me a full-time position managing the catering company. And so I did that while I was considering going back to school. And in fact, I turned down two great jobs, one to come back to Washington to work full-time for Senator Wallop, and the other was to be oppositional researcher for the Congressman Craig Thomas at the time, he was running for the Senate seat because Malcolm Wallop was retiring. I turned both jobs down because I'd given the catering company a one-year commitment to do the job.
And the internship that you had, was that in Wyoming or Washington, D.C.?
No, it was in Washington, D.C.
Okay. And was it a year long or summer?
It was a whatever the semester was September until about January is when I was here.
And so you got credit, not pay?
I didn't get credit because I'd already graduated.
Oh, okay. So did you get paid?
I did get paid. I got paid. My recollection is I got paid about $750 a month. I was paying $500 for a room.
I was going to say, where'd you live?
And I lived on Capitol Hill. A guy who was renting out a bedroom in his townhouse had an advertisement in one of the papers. And he picked me up at the airport. It was a great situation, but I was paying a vast majority of my salary in rent. And so I had to get a second job. My second job was at the Warner Brothers store in Union Station.
I was going to say, I don't think much has changed in the fact that, you know, three-fourths of people's rent or income is going to rent. It's still true today.
Right.
And so then you had the two jobs to kind of help pay your way.
Right.
And so at the end of that year, what'd you do?
Went back to Laramie to go back to what I thought was go back to school, but I did go work for the catering company for a year. Right about at the end of that year, the former legislative assistant to Malcolm Wall became the new congresswoman from Wyoming, Barbara Cuban's chief of staff.
Okay.
She called me and asked if I would be willing to interview for a job on the legislative staff for the new congresswoman. And of course, I jumped at the opportunity and went to interview with the congresswoman there in Wyoming. And they offered me the job on the spot. And within maybe a couple weeks, I was packed up in my old Honda Prelude. I went to the U-Haul store to put a hitch on it so I could haul a U-Haul trailer across the country. That didn't work great, but I did make it.
Oh, you did?
I did make it, yes.
And how long were you on her staff?
I was on her staff from July of 1995 until September of 2002.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So quite a little run, about 7.5 years or so.
Yeah. What was your work for those people who have not worked on Capitol Hill? What was it like?
Yeah. Well, I started as a legislative assistant. Basically, there are two or three legislative assistants in an office, all of which who specialize in a portfolio of issues, healthcare, transportation, whatever it might be, typically focused on whatever committees the member serves on. Did that for a while, and then was promoted to senior legislative assistant, then was promoted to a legislative director. Our press secretary left, and instead of hiring a new person, they asked me to do a press secretary job, which I did.
So you doubled your title.
So I doubled my title. I'm about to tell you that I'm going to triple my title here in a minute, because then Congresswoman Cuban became part of the House leadership. She was secretary of the conference, and I became the title was liaison to House leadership, which was a great job because every Wednesday morning, the House Republican caucus meets in a room in the basement of the Capitol. And there are two people who are always in the room, and that's the secretary's assistant, and that was me at the time, who took roll call.
Great way to get to know the members.
Great way to get to know the members.
They all know who you are.
And everybody who walked through that door, I had to identify because they always wanted to be on the roster to make sure that
the leadership knew they were there. Yep.
And
it was morning, Brian, Congressman so and so. So here they are introducing themselves to you or saying hi to you.
Right. Absolutely.
That's great.
It was a great job. And the best part about the job is occasionally things got so heated that the leadership would ask staff to leave the room. Mm-hmm. Because there were typically chiefs of staff and other House leadership staff in the room. But when things got really heated, everybody had to leave the room that wasn't a member of Congress except for me. There may have been one or maybe two other people, but for the most part, we were the only ones in the room. So we got to hear a lot of great stuff from especially during times that were getting heated.
Right. What were some of the heated arguments that you remember, if you do?
I'm not entirely sure I would remember specifically, but there were a lot of healthcare related issues going on at the time. I believe they were adding a new benefit under Medicare. They were reforming some of the healthcare programs, and so I remember adding the prescription drug benefit was a very heated subject at the time. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of things going on. I mean, you have to remember this was for the most part, it was Newt Gingrich was still the speaker during some of this. There were a lot of issues happening, and so it was a volatile time, and you know, Republicans were still trying to get their feet under them, so there were some hiccups along the way.
And they were in the majority at that point.
They absolutely were, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So what's that title again? We'll have to...
Liaison to the House Leadership.
I like that. That's a good one. Our listeners, that's the job that you want. And then the Democrats on the other side, do they have a similar weekly meeting with
their...
Okay.
I don't know if it's at the same time, but they definitely have a Democratic caucus meeting.
Meeting like that. Okay. And then what'd you do after that?
Well, I have one more job title to throw at you. I became communications director because...
In addition to the other three?
That's right. Because, now listen, the communications director wasn't a real heavy lift. Basically, what it was it was me handing over the press secretary responsibilities to a new hire.
Okay.
Somebody who actually knew what they were doing.
Okay.
And me just kind of overseeing all of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, four titles. That's...
Well, the great part about being a legislative director and knowing the legislative part of it, it really makes you a great press secretary because reporters who call, no disrespect to reporters, but they're not typically experts on the issues. They're asking for information. And you're, being an expert, you can really... You're educating them. You can kind of guide them down the road that you want them to go down. So mm-hmm. It was a great experience really being able to get the information that we wanted out to the reporters in a proper way.
And so you're the chief of staff.
Well, we had a chief of staff.
Oh, you did?
So
okay.
I definitely was not the chief of staff.
Okay. So you're essentially everything else.
I was the head of the legislative department.
What the heck is the chief of staff doing all this time?
Yeah.
Just sitting back.
Being my boss, telling me what to do.
Nice to be the boss.
It was.
Get Brian in here. We need a communications director. Yep. Get Brian. No, Brian's already got three jobs. No. Give him one more. What about you, Chief of Staff? No, I'm good. I'm the chief.
You know, in a small House office, much different than the Senate office, everybody has to...
Yeah. How many staffers on a congressman's... How many are you talking about?
Maybe there were 10
in the
Washington office, and that's even probably more depending on how many interns you have at the time.
So and most small. Of them are in one room.
That's right.
Right next to each other.
That's right.
Yeah, having a meeting with one, and there's someone right next...
If you're lucky, you have two suites, but for the most part, you just have one.
Right.
As opposed to the almost entire hallway that Senator Malcolm Wallop had, and people were able to spread out.
How different are the House and Senate sides up on the Hill?
They're very different. The House is much more active. Maybe you could compare it to more like a fraternity house because it was close-knit, a lot of camaraderie, staff knew each other, it was fun. There was a lot to do, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Senate was much more of a grown-up place to work. There were much more serious people working in the Senate, and they were probably a little bit older than the people who were working in the House.
Okay. I was talking to a state legislator who was thinking about running for the state Senate in their state, and he's leaning towards not running for the state Senate because he said, every time I go up to the state Senate, I feel like I'm sitting in a library, whereas when I'm down in the House... He used the same term. He said it's just like a... Actually, he said Grand Central Station. He said it's just a lot of activity and very different feel.
Right. And I think it's the same. Either they're getting younger or I'm getting older. It just seems like certainly in general, the atmosphere is still somewhat the same. The Senate is still very deliberative, very serious, and the House is still... serious enough to get their work done, but still a young group over there, and I think they have some of the same characteristics as when I was there.
Yeah, and as it's designed, it's supposed to be more responsive to the people because
That's
they're
right.
up every 2 years, and it works as it really was designed.
Absolutely.
So how did you end up at Home Depot?
After I left Capitol Hill, and I reluctantly left, I was... asked at one point by an outside lobbyist working for Duke Energy if I was interested in leaving the Hill to come to Duke Energy. And at the time, I was not. I was still doing a lot of these jobs, and things were still exciting.
So your tenure was a little longer than most people.
I don't know if that's longer. In total, I was probably on the Hill for about 9 years. But
and you enjoyed it?
I loved every second of it.
Okay.
Absolutely. It's one of the best places. I would recommend it to anybody.
So young people listening, you think getting an internship on the Hill, doing anything, was a wonderful experience?
It's an incredible experience. You get a wide array of different experiences. And if they're anything like me, and they are fascinated by politics. My first experience working in the Senate, even as an intern, I went to the health care hearing that First Lady Hillary Clinton was testifying at and was asked to take notes for the legislative assistant who was actually in charge of healthcare issues. And so that was an incredible experience. And as I look back at it, it was my version of Hollywood, because I walked into the back room of the Senate Finance Committee and the Secretary of Labor at the time, Robert Reich, was standing there next to Al Simpson, who was, again, another senator from Wyoming. Bob Dole was in the room. Robert Packwood was there. All these iconic people who I, at the time, really thought a lot of. It was an incredible experience for me. So if you have that desire, it's an incredible place to work. You'll find some of your best friends for your life working on the Hill.
So was that during the Hillary Care, as they refer to it, or whatever?
It was. Hearings basically regarding universal health care.
Yep.
So yeah, Clinton Care, or however they were talking about it. At the time, that's exactly what was going on.
Yeah. So you, the Duke Energy, you were talking about exploring that opportunity.
Yeah, so I was approached informally about going over there, and at the time I had really no desire to leave the Hill, but as circumstances were coming into place and I was about to get married, we were buying a house together, we were going to start a family and do all these things, even though they were incredibly generous with my salary in the house, I needed to move on and make more money. Again, reluctantly wanting to go off and do that. So when they approached me a second time, several months later, I agreed to go do that. And I spent about a year total working for Duke Energy.
And you left that to go to Home Depot?
I did.
How did that happen?
Well, it happened, again, not because I necessarily wanted to. Although Duke Energy wasn't a great fit for me. This was during the Enron scandal.
Okay.
There were market manipulation issues that were happening. There were California blackouts and brownouts. And Duke Energy was part of, as were all electric utilities at the time, part of this situation.
Having to respond to it.
And it was more a case of doing damage control than it was about anything. And it wasn't necessarily what I left the Hill to do.
Mm-hmm.
So about 6 months into my time at Duke Energy, I had a great job review, and things looked like they were going okay. And about 5 months later, a new CEO came on board and cut about 30% of the workforce. We had a 9-person office here in Washington working for Duke Energy Government Affairs. And of that 9-person office, 3 of us were let go. And I was one of them. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I got a good severance. At the time, it didn't seem like a great thing. But in retrospect, it definitely was. I was already looking for another job. I didn't fit well at Duke Energy. And it gave me the opportunity to explore different things, including the opportunity at Home Depot.
And so you ended up getting hired there.
Yeah.
Part of their federal team here in Washington?
Part of the federal team in Washington. They were just starting their Washington, D.C. office. They only had really the new head of the office had come on. He preceded me by about 18 months.
And what year is this about now?
This was then 2004.
Okay.
And started there and, again, evolved into a lot of different roles within the company, doing, like you said, federal government affairs, but then evolved to do some state government affairs, ultimately in charge of state government affairs. And we had some facilities up in Canada, and I started working in Ottawa a little bit doing Canadian government affairs.
Wow. So 2004... Home Depot is not the Home Depot it is today. It is a young, expanding quickly, probably having a lot of local battles. It's almost, you're clearly not in the startup phase, but you're in the early growth stage at that point.
Yeah, both as a company, but especially as a government affairs office, because they hadn't had a government affairs office in Washington before.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it actually was a fairly well-established company. I think at least at one point in those early years, it was a Fortune 12 company, $90 billion in revenue. It was growing. We had a brand new CEO, Bob Nardelli, who had come from GE,
mm-hmm.
who was acquiring a lot of different assets, and he was really taking the company in a new direction. What was really nascent at the time was this government affairs operation, And if you can imagine a couple of guys who were working in government affairs for Home Depot, just kind of scratching our way forward to try to figure out how we could make something out of this very young office. And so we did a lot of work and we stumbled into a lot of great things. But the key was we had a very supportive CEO who really loved Washington. And when you have that combination, you can do a lot of great things.
And the CEO, Frank Blank, was he after Nardella?
He was. He was okay. Immediately following Nardella.
Okay. And did you overlap with him at all?
Yeah, we absolutely did. Now, Frank was a completely different person than Bob Nardella. Like I said, Bob liked to come to Washington a lot and mm-hmm. loved all of the pomp and circumstance around it. Mm-hmm. And Frank Blake, one of his first things he said to us was, I've been there, I've done that, because he worked in the Bush White House. So
he knew
this world.
Right.
And he said, I don't need to go to another Washington Christmas party or White House party. I've done it all. And so he was much more of a, tell me what you need and I'll be there to do it for you, but I don't need to be there all the time.
And so at that time, with the state government relations, is most of the work where new stores are going in, or what is your, is that the primary?
Some of it was. California was always a battleground state for us because we had a lot of stores and we had at the time a huge issue with something that we called at the time, and I don't know if it's still called this, but it's day laborers, people who would stand out in front of our stores, who would solicit work, undocumented, some were, and to address this problem, cities, counties, the state were pushing us to do certain things to, you know, try to solve this problem. Some of those things were actually building day labor centers on our parking lots to house some of the day labor workers, something that we weren't necessarily wanting to do. There were legal and other issues around doing that. So we actually hired a somebody to take over state government affairs work in California. And we also had somebody in our headquarters in Atlanta doing most of that region. And I was housed here in the Washington, D.C. office, and I did a lot of the work having to do with kind of some of the northeastern states. And so it was great. I spent a lot of time in places that nobody would want to spend time in otherwise, but it was, again, valuable experience. If you want to do lobbying work, you say yes to everything. If you have to go spend a week in Albany, you go spend a week in Albany during the winter. If you are told that you need to go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and work on some issues, you go to Harrisburg. So it's the way you achieve a higher level. If you continuously say, that's not a place where I want to spend time, then you're probably not going to get the consideration to move up.
Right. You're also obviously dealing with all of the typical issues that retailers have to deal with.
Oh, absolutely.
And you're a big retailer.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. We were dealing with, on the federal level, we were dealing with, especially post 9/11, we were working on container security issues, support issues, different technologies that would secure containers from weapons of mass destruction that were always assumed to be coming into the country via a shipping container. Mm-hmm. One of the first things that we put on the board at Home Depot was this issue of a duty being assessed on a product. In this case, it was a ceiling fan. That typically these duties are assessed because there's no domestic production of, or they're trying to protect domestic production of that product. In this case, there was no domestic production of the product. It was all coming in from overseas, yet this duty still was on these fans. And we were able to get the duty taken off the fan, and it was a huge revenue boost for the company.
Wow.
People who otherwise wouldn't pay attention to government affairs started paying attention. And it was one of those things where you start, I think when I started at Home Depot, we had a small couple hundred thousand dollars in our political action committee account. When I left, I think now they're up to several million dollars. And all that grew because when you can assign value to a government affairs operation, you get buy-in from your employees. And when they see that there's a value there, they're willing to chip in a little bit. And there was incredible, Home Depot really knows how to do government affairs from the store level all the way up to the top executives, everybody is engaged. Everybody knows what the issues are. Everybody has the talking points. And it's really a great operation.
And that's a great example of government affairs really helping business interact with government. A really great example.
Yeah.
Were you there during the security breach at Home Depot?
I was not. I had thankfully already left.
But and they've been widely commended for how they handled that.
Yes.
All right, so you leave Home Depot. Are we now at BMW?
Yes.
Excellent. This is what our listeners have been waiting for, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, I, again, reluctantly left.
Were you not looking?
I was not looking.
All right. So the key, the lesson here is don't look. If you don't look for a job, they're going to come knocking all the time.
Yeah. But if you need a job, you should go look for
yes,
it.
Yes.
No, I was perfectly happy. You mentioned kind of starting at that time. I think our stock price was somewhere in the $20 range, $20 to $30 range. I believe now it's maybe close to $200.
Okay.
I was, as they used to call it, or maybe still do call it, the golden handcuffs. I was had no incentive to leave that company because I would then leave several hundred thousand dollars on the table of stock that I couldn't vet, that was invested yet, that I could not exercise before I left. And so I definitely did not want to leave. And if I was going to leave, I'd have to leave for a really good reason. And I got a job that made me leave for a really good reason. I was recruited by an executive search firm.
Which firm, if you don't mind?
Korn Ferry.
Okay.
A really great guy and a good friend. And
based here in Washington?
Yes.
Do they specialize in government affairs?
They do. A guy over there named Nels Olson is the head of that. And
okay.
Is an incredible guy. They really know what they're doing, and I now understand why companies retain executive search firms to do these searches. I think they really are incredibly capable of what they're doing. They winnow down potentially hundreds of prospects down to a few. I think they get it right when they pick those few. And I can only say that because I'm a product of it, that maybe it works great, but I also understand that it's hard to get in that world of executive search firms. But once you're in it, it's a great place to be because you're always being asked, I shouldn't say always, you're regularly being asked about openings around town.
Hard to get into that business, executive search.
No, I'm saying it's hard for a potential somebody like me
to get on their radar. Okay.
That's a good way of saying it.
Got it.
Absolutely.
So did you know him before he reached out to you?
He was in some of the same social circles I was, but I can't imagine that he actually knew who I was.
Okay.
I think the key to, or at least one of the keys to executive search firms and getting on their radar is through referrals.
Okay.
I do a lot of that type of work. I've referred several people to Korn Ferry and others around town. And like I said, it's a hard thing to get into.
And so BMW was obviously a client, and
yes,
they were looking to fill a position,
yes,
and he reached out to you.
That's right.
And you interviewed, got hired, and what was your first job at BMW?
Yeah, well, it's the same job that I have today, but it
okay.
was very different at the time. So I love to tell the story because working for a foreign anything has its ups and its downs, and I got to experience one of the downs right away because my first interview was on July 4th.
Oh, jeez.
And so
where was it? In D.C.?
Here in D.C.
Okay.
We always spend my wife is from Atlanta. We always go to Atlanta for July 4th.
Okay.
And they went, but I stayed behind to do the interview. And I'm certainly glad that I did. But gives you a sense as to our holidays really aren't all
right,
that meaningful
right.
necessarily. But
was your second interview on Thanksgiving?
No, my second interview was about mid-August or so. And I received notice from them about maybe mid-September that they were moving forward with me.
Okay.
And my first day on the job was almost 6 years ago to the day. It was the 1st of November. And so now 6 years I've been in the position. But I was taking over for a guy who was retiring, who'd been in the job for about 20 years or so. Did a fine job around town, but they were looking for somebody. There were two key things that they wanted from their new person in D.C. They wanted more access, and they wanted the company to have a higher profile.
Okay.
And they thought somebody coming in from a company like Home Depot that really did this the right way was what they were looking for. And so with that comes a certain amount of challenges, because as a German company, they're somewhat reluctant to be too out front on policy issues, especially from the on some of these key important issues, greenhouse gas and CAFE standards and you know, taxes and things like that. I don't do the same sort of advocacy that I did at Home Depot.
Okay.
And so it's a very different cultural environment for me. But now that I have 6 years of experience doing it, I feel a lot more comfortable.
And tell us about your office. How many people in your office, and how do you all spend most of your time?
Yeah, I have now three, including myself, registered lobbyists. When I started 6 years ago, it was my predecessor and his assistant.
Okay.
And now we've grown to seven people. We have myself and, like I said, two people who are registered lobbyists, so we're doing that. I have a person who does diplomatic work. So she handles our interactions and relationships with all the embassies. We are very, obviously very strong at the German embassy, but we also, the BMW Group owns Mini and Rolls-Royce, both British automakers. And so we're very strong over at the British embassy as well. But then we build engines in Austria, and we do work in almost every market. And so we do a lot of relationship building at the embassies. Plus, we also have a diplomatic sales program. And although we kind of carve that out a little bit, she's responsible for the relationship with the embassy to give them the information about the diplomatic sales program and then hand it off to the sales guys to do the rest of that business. But we have fleets of cars at embassies all over. We armor cars and sell them also to the government, and they send those cars overseas to their diplomats as well. So we do some of that business as well in our office. I have an engineer in my office to help us through technical issues and interfaces with agencies like NHTSA on safety. I also have in my office a person who's responsible for Latin America.
Okay. Do you do much work on the state and local level?
Yes, we are responsible for the state.
Okay.
And so we have offices in Sacramento, California, and we have an office in our manufacturing facility in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Okay. How many employees do you have in the U.S.?
A total of all employees?
Yes.
We have roughly about, I would say, 11,000 or so.
Okay. How many plants in the U.S.?
We just have the one plant in Spartanburg.
Okay.
And that makes up a vast majority of our employees. We're talking about more than 10,000 employees there.
Okay.
So otherwise, all we have in the United States, I say all we have, it's actually still a sizable number of assets here. We have our national sales company, which is located in New Jersey.
Okay.
And that's our America's headquarters.
Okay.
Our chairman of all the Americas sits there.
Okay.
He's also our North American CEO.
Okay.
And our executives, for the most part, all sit in that New Jersey office. But we have financial service operations in Ohio. We have a data center in Chicago. We have regional distribution facilities all over.
And dealers across.
Dealers. We have a design facility in California, a tech center in California. But our jewel in our American crown is the manufacturing facility in South Carolina.
And how do state issues, how are they different than your federal issues?
They're very different. The issues might be somewhat similar, but the way you approach them are very different. I worked, like I said, at Home Depot doing this for a long time. And frankly, it moves much faster than even the pace at the House of Representatives. It is quick. Things come at you at light speed, and you miss a lot. And I'm thankful that we have a great trade association in the Auto Alliance that does a vast majority of auto industry issues at the state level. Otherwise, we would never be able to keep up.
Right.
So what we do is we support those efforts. If it's necessary that we be there to advocate on behalf or opposed to something, we will do that. But for the most part, we do mostly relationship building at the governor's level in most of the states that we're in.
Okay. And then how many employees do you have worldwide?
We have a roughly 130,000 or so.
Wow.
Yeah, all over the world. There's almost an employee or an asset for BMW in almost every market in the world.
How often do you have to go to Munich?
Well, for better or for worse, it used to be a lot more. And I think because of the fact that they really want you to be immersed in the business, I was there a lot early on, several times a year. And that has gotten pared down dramatically recently. There's a realization that my job is here in Washington. That's 6 years now. I know the business really well. And there's fewer and fewer reasons for me to go back to Munich. But I love being there. It's a great city. I love Germany and love Europe. And it's a great experience for a guy who grew up in North Dakota and Wyoming to work for a German premium auto manufacturer. It's really a cool experience.
I bet. I bet you feel like someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, Brian, it's, you know, you're not supposed to be here.
That's right.
So the electric vehicles that you have, all the different vehicles, I'm not even really sure where to start. I guess why don't we start with the electric vehicles?
Sure.
Is that the future?
It is the future. For the future, it's definitely
the future, I guess,
for us.
Is here. Yeah, yeah.
And it is here, but it's coming, and it's the uptake is going to be a lot more dramatic and more rapid in the next couple of years than it has been. It's definitely a new technology that consumers haven't entirely embraced yet. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And maybe Tesla is doing things a little bit differently, and consumer acceptance of that technology is maybe a little bit different. But, and we have also, whether it's, you would call them headwinds or what, whatever you would characterize it as, BMW is known as a particular automotive brand, high performance, luxury, etc. And if you put a true BMW enthusiast in an electric car when they've been used to driving an M3 or an M5, it's a much different experience. And so the uptake of consumer acceptance for this brand for electric vehicles is difficult. And again, it has a lot to do with headwinds of infrastructure not being fully developed.
Right.
I'd give you an example of California is a great place to sell electric vehicles. The climate is perfect for it. The infrastructure is there. The incentives are there. And there's a particular demographic of people who want that vehicle. And there's it just so happens that there's also mandates for those vehicles to be sold in California. Think about places like where we sell some of the best sales that we have are in Norway. Norway has great incentives. They allow electric vehicles on bus routes and high occupancy lanes and et cetera, et cetera. And there's one of the highest uptakes of electric vehicles in the world is in Norway because you have to have the incentives behind it for consumers to really accept them in a meaningful way.
And when you say infrastructure, do you mean charging stations?
Charging stations,
okay.
Right.
Okay, yeah. And in the U.S., it's just being kind of built out now.
Right.
What are some of the other vehicles or models, rather, that you get most asked about or most popular? We mentioned the 2002 earlier, which is obviously almost of a cult following.
Yeah.
Any other vehicles that people ask you about all the time?
I'll tell you, and you can try to figure out some of the best things about my job, and there are a lot of great things about my job, but the best thing about my job is that I get a new car so often that I can barely keep up with the presets on my XM radio.
Oh my God.
I always forget to take the Easy Pass off my windshield. And if I lose one more garage opener in one of the cars that I send back, I'm going to be in big trouble. I get a car every couple thousand miles. So there was a point in time where I was trading out cars every 6 weeks or so. It's one of the best parts of the program for BMW.
And is that to get you driving all the different models so you're familiar with them?
That's right.
Okay.
Right. And then I also enjoy the fact that I get a small fleet of cars in my garage in my office that I can loan out to people who are considering buying cars, but these are people who are part of our network and you know, people who are eligible to be able to do this. You know, it used to be where you could probably do this with government employees, but those things have gotten a little bit less available. But yeah, this is for us to be able to demonstrate the products, show the product, allow people, if they're considering buying a car, the ability to do more than just a test drive, that they can, we can lend them a car for the weekend. But you asked what some of the best cars are. I've had an Austin Yellow M3. And if you look at the color of Austin Yellow, it's quite something. It wasn't really something that my wife wanted parked in front of our house for a long period of time, but it was parked in front of our house for a period of time. The best car that I've had so far, and it was based solely on the fact that my previous CEO for the Americas took me under his wing and really was incredibly generous to me, is we have a car called the i8. And the i8 is part of our electric. But the i8 is a hybrid, actually. A lot of people don't know this. It has a small little three-cylinder engine, a 1.5-liter three-cylinder engine in the back of the car, and one of the best and most fun cars to drive. My wife didn't necessarily like it because, as you might know, it has the gullwing doors, and it has a high shelf kind of on the side. It's hard to get in and out of the car. Let's just say it that way. And for somebody who's as tall as I am, I actually developed back problems getting in and out of that car. I already had pre-existing back problems anyway, but it didn't help that. And for women getting in and out of the car, it takes a bit of a delicate dance to do that. But I had three of those over the course of 3 years. And just a great, iconic car to have, and it was an incredible driving experience.
So if you were not working, if you were going to have to buy a BMW, and you're not working, so you're going to have to pay for it, and so there's going to have to be some practical aspect, and money's not a concern, which BMW model do you buy?
Yeah, so it actually is probably what we have parked in front of our house right now. So my wife also gets a car, and she has a... she has a 320 station wagon, and so we have that, and she loves it. She's a station wagon person, so she absolutely loves that car. And I drive an X5, so the SUV, great practical car to have, but drives like a sedan, but sits up nice and high and can get through. I put the X5 in the same category as our Yellow Lab. It's very domesticated, but it has so much potential if you put it in the right situation. So the X5 is great to just drive on the streets, but you know, big snowstorm comes over us this winter, it'd be a great car to be able to get around town in as well. So
Great.
it's a fantastic car, and I only say that because we're about ready to start production of the next largest SUV that we have in our Spartanburg facility, called the X7.
Yes.
And do yourself a favor, go online, check out the reviews of the X7. There, it's an incredible car, but it's the next size up, a true and proper 6 to 7 passenger SUV.
Okay. Any other future models coming out that you're focused on or talking about?
Yeah, well, not necessarily. A lot of the cars that we currently have are going through redesign. And so we have a new X5 coming out for model year 2019. We have an upcoming all-electric X3. Mm-hmm. And we have a competition model M2, which is the small, really great sports car that if you're a BMW enthusiast, again, And a lot of even the folks who write for some of the car magazines and auto shows, they absolutely love this new little M2. It's what a lot of people characterize as the iconic BMW. It's small, it's agile, it's nimble, it's fast, etc. So that's it's a great car as well. But any car that has an M badge in front of it, which is the high performance, is a car that is highly desired.
Yes. Last topic, internships. Do you have internships in your office?
We do. We have internships. Typically what we do, we have now, I think, coming up on a 30-year endowment at Georgetown University at the Foreign Service School. We have the BMW Center for German and European Studies. It's a graduate school program, and we have hired a lot of our interns from that program. In fact, one of the people who's specializing in trade in my office right now is a graduate of that program, became an intern for us, and now is on permanent staff.
Wow.
A full-time staff at my office. We find those interns to be, and graduates from that program to be incredible interns. But we've kind of gotten to a point where we don't want to be so exclusive as to just going there. So we've now, I think our interns serving the previous semester as well as now this semester are both from American University. The person we have serving as an intern now is working a little bit of part-time. Typically it's a full-time internship, but she's going to school as well, so we have her working when it's convenient for her to work. And so we can be somewhat flexible. But yeah, we have one intern, and we like to have interns year-round. So we don't just have the summer internship, but we have a fall and a spring semester as well.
Okay. Well, Brian, this has been great. We appreciate you coming by. It was great to talk to you, and good luck in the next 2 years.
Thanks, Jim. It was great talking to you.
Well, there it is, Brian Jacobs. What a great guy, great interview. Learned a lot about Capitol Hill and his work at Home Depot and BMW. Hope you enjoyed the interview, and remember, they have internships, so if you are looking for one, you can reach out to their office. And remember, you can subscribe and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts. If you are an Android user, you will be happy to know that we are now on Google Podcasts. You can also find us on Stitcher and Blueberry. I don't know why we just don't say you can really find us anywhere. I don't know why I have to go through all these, but, you know, just do what you're told. You can also follow us on Twitter, at The Lobbying Show. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Lobbying Show. If you want more insights into the show regarding our interviews and what we're doing, you can sign up for our Monday morning email, Monday Morning Coffee at The Lobbying Show. You can find that on our website. Thank you very much. See you next Monday.